Welcome to Kingston Reid's Word to the Wise podcast series for HR and safety professionals. Welcome to our fourth episode in the Kingston Reid Word to the Wise podcast series. I'm Krista Lennard, partner at Kingston Reid.
And I'm Rachel Bevan, a senior associate in our Sydney office.
In this episode, we take a look at how to manage the aftermath of a misconduct investigation and steps you can take to mitigate further complaints, limit psychological and emotional fallout, and manage those impacted by the investigation. Lucy and Alice spoke about some of the inherent difficulties in getting the investigation process right, and it's within this context that we look at the outcome of what happens next.
That's right. And poor workplace investigations can leave a path of destruction, often with long-lasting effects within the health unit and a very real psychological impact on the individuals involved. And so it's nothing to take lightly. For the person who was the subject of the investigation, the process has been incredibly stressful. Firstly, they've had allegations that they've had to address, which can often come as quite a shock. They're often suspended, and that can be quite stressful for them as well. They can be waiting for an interminable length of time for the finalisation of the investigation, and then wait for the communication of findings and then a possible sanction. So it's very often the case that the person who has stood down to face the allegations considers their reputation as being tarnished. And that's the case even when there's no finding of misconduct at the end of the process. They might be completely vindicated, but they've still been badly affected by this. Their confidence is often destroyed, and they can become highly suspicious of the process and indeed management as well.
Right, and that's just the accused. There are also the other employees who have been implicated in the process as witnesses. These individuals often don't choose to be part of the investigation, and the net effect is that they're forced to take sides, or at least that's what they feel, or they're needing to protect their own positions and limit the information they can give for fear of rocking the boat further. And fear of victimisation, Rachel, is a very real and common phenomenon amongst not just the complainant, but also the witnesses. And despite efforts to maintain confidentiality as far as practicable, it is often very clear which witnesses have given which evidence, and when findings based on credit are made, this can also have an ongoing and detrimental impact on those participating. And then you have the complainant. It's an incredibly emotional time for them, and one that can exacerbate stress and feelings of anxiety. So, Rachel, if we put this in context, it all comes down to, one, ensuring the investigation process is conducted properly with procedural fairness afforded to those involved. And secondly, making sure that the fallout is managed just as tightly, with a view not just to communicating an outcome to the complainant and respondent, but also with a risk analysis of the potential impact for the specific team and the workplace generally.
That's true. I think a really good way to look at this is to look at a relatively common scenario to see how we can manage this with a view to minimising the fallout for all of the individuals involved. So I'll give you a scenario, Krista. You've had a team member who's been accused of bullying by another team member, and the allegations involve accusations of favouritism of others within the unit and deliberate exclusion of the complainant from training opportunities and team meetings. So because of the nature of the complaint, it's been necessary to interview the broader team, and essentially everyone knows about the complaint. The complainant and the alleged protagonist, and each person has a different take of the situation depending on where they sit within that team environment. So you've got a lot of people who are involved. They conduct an investigation, and the investigator finds that the allegations are not substantiated, or perhaps some of them are substantiated, but the disciplinary action does not involve termination of employment. So everyone is still working there within that team once the investigation finishes. The respondent, who has been stood down for the duration of the investigation, returns to the workplace, and there are clear fault lines now drawn within the team. You know, everyone's been involved, and it's hard just to draw a line in the sand and move on. So what can you, as an HR business partner or a manager of that team, do going forward?
Well, I think at a macro level, there will be a need for some sort of mending of the fracture, as you identified, if the complainant and the respondent are to work effectively together again. And working out how to facilitate that mend is not easy, but there are a few simple and very essential steps you can take. it's really important to clearly communicate the organization's expectations regarding code of conduct and workplace behavior. And that's done well, I think, and frequently. It's also important to reiterate the need to maintain confidentiality around what was discussed during the investigation process, and again, to all involved. Now, that will do two things. Firstly, it does enable a leveling to take place, meaning that a line can be drawn in the sand. And moving forward, everybody is directed and is on notice of what is expected of them. Now, that means then if somebody can't get over the past and continues to draw the past up, they can be directed back to that direction and attempts made to move forward. For the respondent, it's also very important to reiterate that victimization is unlawful and will not be tolerated. And I guess that's a fact that should be reiterated to all and not just the respondent.
So that's a good first step. Once these directions have been issued, it may be that there is a need to facilitate, further training on appropriate workplace conduct. I mean, this could be done generally and target the whole team or indeed the whole organisation if there's a need for that. Or it might be specific training required where the respondent was found to have engaged in behaviour. So it can be a very targeted training or something that's more general.
Right. And you may need to consider developing a communication protocol if two individuals feel they can't work with each other, or if the complainant has ongoing concerns and doesn't agree with the findings. And that's often, can be quite a common outcome. Now, that protocol should clearly identify what is expected in relation to work interactions between the two individuals. It should identify the ability for either party to raise concerns immediately with a separate manager. And that means that you avoid issues starting to fester again and become bigger than they need be. And the situation can be managed in real time and address real concerns of the parties as they attempt to move forward. It may be that the organisation has to issue a direction that the complainant work with the respondent, or vice versa, that in of itself is a lawful, reasonable direction, which then can be managed accordingly.
I mean, the problem is such directions can lead to unhappy and disaffected individuals, so you've got to sort of manage all of those expectations. I think a common spin on this scenario, though, Krista, is where the respondent is the complainant's manager. So we've just talked about where it's two co-workers working with each other, but what happens when someone's raised a complaint about their manager and then their manager needs to return to the workplace? And it may be the case that the complaint's been made shortly after the commencement of, some sort of formal performance discussions as well. What further actions could be taken in that situation?
Yeah, right. And a direction may be over formalistic in a case, but sometimes it might be necessary where the individual, again, doesn't agree or doesn't see that they should be working with their manager. Look, in this scenario where the complainant is being performance managed and they've alleged bullying, the organisation really needs to also put in place some support mechanisms for the manager, assuming, of course, the finding of the investigation was that their performance management process has been reasonable. And those support mechanisms could extend to, having, again, somebody else with them, shadowing them on that process moving forward.
Yes, and I mean, you could have increased support from HR. They could become more involved in the performance process. Might need to rely on some coaching or some templates or other tools to assist that process. Just any support you can rally around that manager to assist them going forward. I mean, I think you raised a good point before, Krista, when you spoke about the need to manage and monitor the whole team environment. I mean, in this case, some extra support may need to be given to the complainant as well. Because remember, they reported what they perceived to be bullying and the investigator and the breach decision maker didn't agree with them. But that hasn't changed their mind as to the fact that they were themselves bullied. So for them to understand why the decision was made and the reason behind that is really important if they're going to work together going forward. And equally, giving that person some comfort around the fact that they spoke up and despite the findings that were made, there will be no detriment to them going forward, is critical.
Well, what about a team member who has been off sick for a period of time, say due to a bullying or harassment investigation? What steps need to be taken to re-engage that worker and return them to work?
Well, that's a really good question. And it does frequently arise where there's been a difficult investigation. You know, the team member doesn't agree with the outcome of the investigation, and they maintain that, you know, despite that finding, they are still unable to return to the workplace. I mean, look, things become a lot more tricky at this point because, again, you're dealing with an individual who is presenting with medical certificates that legitimately say they're unfit due to, say, a workplace stressor. And the stressor, of course, has been investigated and found not to have been substantiated, but the employee nonetheless legitimately believes that they can't return to work. Now, there are a number of things that can be done at this point, which will heavily depend on the work environment, the size of the team, what resourcing you have available. I mean, in a perfect world, if two people can't work together, you separate them. However, that is easier said than done. There are issues of consent if the person is moved. You can't just necessarily move someone without their agreement. They might complain that there's some detriment involved in moving them. And then there's not always the capacity to move someone. Finally, even if the individuals are separated, it doesn't mean that the team member that is off work will readily be able to return to work. And on top of this, you have a finding that there was no misconduct. So there is no reason, strictly speaking, that the individual should not return.
And this is a scenario where on certain matters we've worked on, our client, the LHD, has been able to offer, after consideration of medical advice, or essentially direct the worker back to work and continue to issue lawful, reasonable directions that they return. And the failure of that compliance with that lawful, reasonable direction becomes a disciplinary issue in of itself.
Mm. It is something that needs to be closely managed, though. Okay, so what about a scenario where an employee is terminated following an investigation into misconduct? So you've had the investigation, findings have been made, person's been terminated. What about those people who remain in the workplace?
So think about it. Messaging to staff. Quite often there are legitimate limitations about what can be said. So keeping the messaging factual and to key points that have been agreed with HR. It's not necessary to disparage or speak generally about the person following their exit. The same goes for stakeholder communications. That's a really important thing. And reminding those who have been involved, particularly if it's been quite a fractious workplace environment, of the need to maintain confidentiality and, again, not speak negatively about a former staff member is critical. Consider what, if any, support is needed on an ongoing basis for those affected by the conduct. Again, these are issues that often arise after many weeks, months, if not years, of alleged conduct and dysfunction within units or teams. So it's important to think about how you start to mend that and change the culture moving forward. And use this opportunity to revisit more generally the organisation's expectations around workplace conduct, appropriate behaviour, values and the like. Training is not a one-off isolated incident. We know that. It needs to be continuous, and it's sometimes most effectively conducted following a fractious event such as a workplace conduct or bullying investigation. And it reinforces the organisation's commitments to its values, its policies and procedure. Look, if the exited employee commences litigation, there are also steps that can be taken to assist those staff who may need to be involved in assisting the defence to those proceedings. And again, that's where HR officers should partner with legal to ensure that they're covering all bases on that front.
Now, it's good to think about, you know, what have the courts and tribunals said about things like this? Well, they've highlighted the importance of both considering the impact of workplace investigations on employees' mental health and then the consequences of failing to do so. You may recall, Krista, in 2017, Woolworths came under fire and what was actually found liable for a major depressive disorder which an employee developed following a workplace investigation into his conduct. And this was also a workers' compensation injury case. So the two are often interlinked. So there it was alleged that the employee had repeatedly failed to follow protocols and procedures for entering and exiting the store. And that led to allegations of stealing. Now, the findings of the investigation was that the allegation of stealing was not substantiated. So he was vindicated and he was placed on a performance improvement plan for failing to comply with the company's policies and procedures. Then a month goes by and a colleague tells him that some staff members had asked, you know, why haven't you been sacked? You know, he's been stealing from the store. And the employee subsequently applied for workers' compensation for permanent impairment, claiming, you know, that he was very distressed from hearing these sorts of comments. He'd been ostracized at work and he just couldn't work there anymore. He claimed that the fact that other employees had been made aware of the investigation had caused him injury, and the manner in which, you know, Woolworths had conducted the investigation, which I might add, you know, included a police search of his car in front of other employees, that it resulted in this circulation of rumours, you know, even after he'd been cleared of all the allegations.
But in its defence, the arbitrator agreed with Woolworths that the allegations and the record of interview and the implementation of a performance improvement plan constituted reasonable action. And I think that highlights that whilst there might be at times parts in a process that aren't conducted properly or perfectly, that the overall process here in terms of that investigation with the best intent was reasonable for Woolworths to do.
I mean, however, the arbitrator did then go on to find that the gossip and the co-workers' awareness of these allegations did not reasonably constitute a part of the disciplinary process, and accepted that the distress of being questioned by a colleague about the allegations and being told of others' knowledge, you know, created the employee's perception that there was a pack of dogs mentality, if you like, and that his reputation was ruined. And so it was accepted that this perception was the main factor causing the development of his illness, and ultimately the arbitrator found Woolworths liable for his injury.
So if we think what could be done in this case to mitigate that outcome and to manage the potential impact of psychological harm, we think, well, there's importance in reiterating the confidentiality, as we've spoken about, and that confidentiality not just during an investigation but also after, and including witnesses in this is key. You can't always stop office gossip, but you can certainly create boundaries and set expectations around what is or is not to be discussed at the water cooler. It can be a clear direction that witnesses not discuss the matter further, and there can be consequences which flow if in fact they do. Communicating the outcomes with those involved in the investigation is also key. We often do that well when it comes to obviously the complainant and the respondent, but we don't necessarily communicate overall, even that there's been a finish or a conclusion to the investigation process to others that are involved. And there need not be a detailed explanation, but in a case such as this, it would have been important to not only communicate with the employee in question, but to think about the messaging at the conclusion to others. And that was something that I think in this case Woolworths had failed to do. Conducting the investigation sensitively and in a timely manner is critical. And I know that we often in the organisation situation struggle with this timeliness. Look, the length of an investigation is very commonly an issue in the public sector across the board, not just in health. But delays can cause significant mental health risks. So it's really important to try and limit the time taken in an investigation process and be aware of potential mental health issues. It's a work health safety issue, so you must be able to provide support. You must do an audit and an assessment and monitor an employee's well-being. And then finally, carefully consider which employees need to be involved in the first place.
So, I mean, we've been through a few scenarios there. I think the key things to take away is, you know, don't delay informing parties of the conclusion of the investigation. I mean, and like you've just said, this includes witnesses. And where it's appropriate, communicate the outcome. And, you know, the level of detail you provide will depend on the circumstances of the case and who it is you're communicating to. I mean, secondly, use this as an opportunity to remind participants of the ongoing need to maintain confidentiality and what this means, and that'll go some way to mitigating risks of fallout. I mean, thirdly, you need to manage your unhappy parties. This requires assessing the situation, taking stock of why they are unhappy, managing the conflict between individuals, that might be by way of mediation, issuing communication protocols, workshops, training. Fourthly, acknowledge those that participated in the investigation. You know, it was likely to be very unpleasant and cause them concern and stress. And, you know, it's not what they associate with, you know, their normal working their working day. So it's something that they haven't elected to be involved in. So addressing any ongoing fears of retribution or victimization can be very beneficial. And lastly, you know, take stock. What can be learned from the investigation? How can those learnings be shared across the organization so that you can mitigate risks in the future? And, you know, consider whether it's time for further refresher training.
Well, thank you, Rachel. It's been fun chatting around this issue with you today. It's certainly not an easy one in practice, but we hope that you've taken something away from our podcast series, and we'll talk to you soon.